This is Fresh Air. Derrick Bell became the first African-American faculty member of the Harvard Law School in 1969. In 1990, he took an unpaid leave of absence, saying he wouldn't return until the law school hired and gave tenure to a woman of color. He was dismissed when his protest extended beyond 2 years, the maximum leave that Harvard grants. He's now a visiting professor at NYU Law School. Although Bell is a civil rights lawyer and has worked with the NAACP, he is pessimistic about the court's ability to enforce racial equality. In fact, he's pessimistic that blacks will ever have equality in the United States. He explains why in his new book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well, The Permanence of Racism. The book is a series of parables about racial attitudes. In his story, Space Traders, beings from another planet come to Earth and offer to solve all of America's problems if the aliens can take all the African Americans back to their mother star.
I was trying to look at a situation somewhat in the future, in the year 2000, in which the United States would have an opportunity to correct, in effect, all of its mistakes of the last several generations by one trade. And, of course, there's a lot of debate, and I try to take it day by day. The space traders arrive on New Year's Day in the year 2000, and they indicate that they will give the country 2 weeks and will then await their decision. And each day I look at the various aspects of the society and how they might debate it, what positions they might take.
Yeah, well, you have different groups being willing to make different compromises.
That's right.
What are some of those compromises?
Well, I have a conservative president and his cabinet quite ready to accept a trade because it's going to be an election year, and this certainly gets them out of serious difficulties. Of course, I have the civil rights groups all gathered together, ready to file suits and protest and do all of the usual, usually unproductive things that civil rights groups do. I have the far right TV evangelists favoring the trade because it's God's will. And I have the corporate leaders opposing the trade because it's going to take away valuable markets. And the liberals do what the liberals are usually expected to do, and conservatives follow form as well. And finally, there is a constitutional amendment to deal with the legal issues that is submitted to a popular referendum. It's kind of a loaded deck because civil rights measures always go down to defeat in popular referenda. In any event, the referendum here comes out 70-30 for the trade. And the interesting thing about it is that I ask my audiences usually, if this happened, how would the country vote? And blacks in the audience, almost to a person, are quite certain that the vote would be for the trade. Whites are more ambivalent, but when I ask them to consider very seriously how their home community or the community they know best would vote, their hands slowly, that were clenched in their lap, slowly come up, almost painfully come up into the air, and most believe that their communities would vote for the trade. And that's the point I wanted to make.
So you believe people would vote for a trade?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
You think that African Americans are worse off now than at any time since slavery, and that the advances of the 60s and 70s have been reversed. What makes you say that?
I certainly get a lot of resistance when I say that because they point to all of the success stories, including my own, and say, well, how can you say that? You couldn't have been where you are 30, 40 years ago. And that's right. But that simply masked the real condition of most of black America, certainly the third or so at the bottom. I can't imagine how their condition could be worse, save in slavery. And even in slavery, as some of the comedians, Dick Gregory and others, have pointed out, slavery at least was a full employment law. And blacks have not had a full employment law since then. And as a matter of fact, systematic policies and efforts have resulted in being denied employment.
You're just joining us. My guest is Derrick Bell, and he has a new book called Faces at the Bottom of the Well, The Permanence of Racism. Yeah, you left Harvard on a leave without pay, saying that you wouldn't return until an African-American woman was given tenure at the law school. And after 2 years of your leave without pay, you were dismissed by Harvard because their policy is of a maximum two-year leave.
Right.
Let me ask you, since you think it's very important that African-American women students have African-American women teachers, as an African-American male professor, what do you feel that you offer your African-American students that your white counterpart couldn't provide?
Yeah. I guess one, I teach teach constitutional law, of course, on the Supreme Court and one on civil rights. But in all my courses, I really have to teach the basic messages of my life. And that is that the rewards, the satisfactions, are not in being partner or making $1 million, but in recognizing evils, recognizing injustices, and standing up and speaking out about them, even in absolutely losing situations where you know it's not going to bring about any change, that there are intangible rewards to the spirit that make that worthwhile. And while I certainly miss my position at Harvard, I worked very hard for it, and people tell me I should have stayed and worked from within. In some ways, I am grateful for the opportunity to, in so public a way, practice what I've preached for so long. Because if only a few students get that message, then those few students, to the extent that they are able to practice it in their own lives, will receive the kind of spiritual, soul-satisfying dividends that I think I've received and make me believe that that's really an important thing of what life is all about.
Well, you could make the argument that your method of dealing with this by taking the leave was actually a self-defeating way of handling it, because now the students don't have you there either.
That's right, but there are five other black men, all very capable. And I think that some of them will be more willing to step into the role that I was playing now that I'm not there, that my presence tended to perhaps stifle some of their development as leaders. I learned this hard lesson as a civil rights lawyer when during the 60s I would fly into town and meet with several groups and take down all the information about their problems and the discrimination here in the schools or in the public accommodations, and would fly back to New York and prepare the complaints and get them filed and handle the cases. And I thought that, I tell you, I thought that my place in heaven was assured. But looking back on it, I see that I, by my flying in all, and was really usurping the leadership potential of many local people who, even after I won the case, if they didn't organize and inform the their constituencies of what had been done through the courts, nothing would change. So that I am a much more humble with regard to my role today than I was as a young civil rights lawyer.
Harvard Law School wasn't the first place that you quit in protest. In 1959, you were working in the Justice Department, and you were told to drop your membership in the NAACP.
Because it was a conflict of interest. I was in the new Civil Rights Division, and that seemed strange to me, and I checked with a number of friends in important places, and almost to a person, they told me to stay and work from within. And I've always been a little suspect of that argument. It's very comfortable and convenient, but I'm not sure that it's necessarily accurate. In any event, I decided that I would not resign my membership, and I would wait for them to fire me, which they didn't. They simply moved me out of my office into the hall and started to give me kind of busy work, which was a message that maybe I should leave, and that's what I did. But in that instance, as in so many others, I went back to my hometown, Pittsburgh, and began working as the executive director of the NAACP. And I learned long years later that one of the people I'd gone to for advice, Bill Hastie, who was the first black federal judge, had gone to Thurgood Marshall, his longtime friend, and told him about my situation. So that when Thurgood came through Pittsburgh speaking, he was then general counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, he said, "Boy, what's a lawyer doing in a non-lawyer job?" And I tried to explain. He wasn't even listening. He said, oh, come on, join me in New York, which I did post-haste. Well, that was a marvelous experience, working with the Legal Defense Fund in the early 60s. And it's an experience I wouldn't have gotten had I not done what I thought was right with regard to my NACP membership with the Justice Department.
My guest is law professor Derek Bell. He's the author of the new book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Derek Bell, your book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well, is subtitled The Permanence of Racism. How convinced are you that racism is a permanent part of life in the United States?
Well, I keep hoping that someone in the back of an audience will raise their hand and be recognized and get up and demolish my thesis in a way that I have to confess and surrender and what have you. I keep hoping that will happen. I rather know it won't. It's a conclusion I reach very, very reluctantly. I see the potential for despair in it as well as any of my critics. And yet, I got to tell the truth. And my experience and my study of the whole history of this society indicates that unless changes can take place that I can't imagine are going to take place, then that racism is permanent.
What makes you say that racism is permanent?
Because from the very beginning when slavery, no one ever asked, everybody admits that slavery was horrible, but no one ever asked, why did the poor whites who didn't own slaves, why did they allow that to happen? Because once the slave owners were allowed to establish a system of slavery, then that meant the poor whites were always going to be yeomen, always going to be living rather oppressive lives themselves. They were never going to be able to own slaves or compete with those who did. And yet they did buy into this on the basis of the arguments made, and Edmund Morgan points them out very well in his book, American Slavery, American Freedom, the contradiction of that, by promising the yeomen, the free whites, former indentured servants, that they could be part of the political system too, and they could vote because they were going to lower the poll taxes. But they had to stand together against the ever-present danger of slave revolts, you see. And it worked. So when a slave escaped, it was the poor whites that went rushing off into the marshes to haul him back, you see. And I look back at use the slavery example because it's so stark, it's far enough away so that we can understand it. But those things continue to happen to today, you see. Look at George Bush and the Willie Horton situation. That really is the same form. It's saying they're dangerous down there, and we have to stand together, you see. The family values, maybe I'm getting a little racially paranoid, but it seems to me a facet of the family values, that's that same kind of code wording that says we have to stand together against those people who are having all these babies out of wedlock, who are standing out on the corners instead of getting jobs, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I'm wondering, when you decided to take that unpaid leave of absence from Harvard until they hired an African-American woman professor, tenured, did you think that that would happen and that you'd end up back at Harvard, or did you figure that you were saying goodbye to Harvard Law School?
I thought it was a risk, but there were a couple of possibilities. One, that I knew that there were a number of faculty members who agreed with me, who agreed that one of two women who were there, black women who were there as visitors, really deserved to be there on a permanent basis. And if I thought that rather than simply urge them as I had been doing and sending memos around to all the faculty, that if I took this position, which is probably without very much precedent at Harvard Law School, that they would see, well, Derek Bell is really serious, and we are his colleagues, and therefore we must stand with him in if not taking leave, at least going to the powers that be and demanding that something be done. That didn't happen. I also basically was supporting the students because they had been pushing on this and doing everything, including taking over the dean's office for a couple of years. And I thought there was a chance that they might come up with a new form of protest that would be more effective at pressing their demands. That didn't happen.
We have time for one more question, and I'd like to use that time to find out why you decided to become a lawyer.
It's interesting. When I was a child, I built model airplanes, and I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. But I had no models of blacks as aeronautical engineers or even whites as aeronautical engineers. Plus, my math skills were deficient. But I did, on my paper route, have two lawyers. One was the only black judge in the area, and one was a practicing lawyer. And both of them and their wives were very supportive. They would always invite me in and ask me how I'm doing and give me a cookie or a cup of tea. And I was very impressed. And I thought that I could see my way from where I was to where they were. And I think that has informed much of my effort, particularly at Harvard. It's very difficult to convince those who are at the top of the society how important models are for those who are much closer to the bottom.
Derek Bell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Derek Bell's new book is Faces at the Bottom of the Well. This is Fresh Air.